Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and today
it's Patient Zero. That's our subject.
Yeah, and this next story,
well, it's so huge.
It's the ultimate Patient Zero story, really.
Many of us have lived through this. It's as recent an event. It's such a recent event that it still hurts and it still bleeds.
Yeah,
and in it somewhere is a literally. The patient that is called Zero. So this is...
Yeah, a lot of people are going to help us tell this story, but starting us off is science writer, Radiolab regular, Carl Zimmer.
So in 1981, doctors for the first time describe...
A mysterious, newly discovered disease...
A syndrome.
...which affects mostly homosexual men.
The young men in Los Angeles...
We're dying.
The number of cases has been growing faster and faster.
So far, more than 80 Americans have died.
258 people have died. 625 people have died.
Of course, this is the part we all know, how from those first few cases in L.A., AIDS became one of the deadliest pandemics the world has ever seen.
More dangerous than the plague of the Middle Ages.
But back at the beginning, there was a story that I've not been able to shake for the last 30 years, and it's a story that I want to reimagine right now.
Right after news of this syndrome started to break.
That's science writer David Quammen, who along with Carl will be one of our guides.
Epidemiologists were trying to figure out where...
Where did it come from?
And they were thinking like, well, maybe it's a sexually transmitted disease.
So the CDC launches a study.
Of a group of about 30 patients.
Gay men.
In New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco to see who had had sexual contact with whom.
How do you, is that just a series of interviews with people?
Yeah. Please name all the people that you've slept with.
The CDC eventually releases the results of this survey in the form of a diagram.
Like a network drawing. With circles representing patients and then lines representing sexual contact.
And each patient, each little circle, was numbered.
New York, 7. Los Angeles, 12.
So you didn't know who was who, but you could tell immediately when you look at this thing. That of all the 30 or so circles, there was one circle that was special. It had lines coming out in every direction.
7 or 8 emanating from him.
Like the hub of a wheel. Except all the spokes on this wheel connected to other wheels, which then shot out and connected to other wheels, fanning outward. At the center of it all was that one little circle, numbered...
0. Number 0.
As far as we know, that was the first time that you ever get the term patient zero.
Patient zero was a man, the central victim and victimizer.
This is from a 60 Minutes special in 1988. That year, a reporter named Randy Schultz had written a book called And the Band Played On that for the first time revealed the identity of Patient Zero.
He was a French-Canadian.
A very handsome airline steward.
Named Gaetan Dugas.
Gaetan Dugas.
Patient Zero.
A few minutes later in the report, Schultz comes on to describe
a guy who has got unlimited sexual stamina.
This sexual athlete who would fly from one hot spot to the next because of his job, having sex with literally thousands of men.
And as he knew he was dying, at least according to Randy Schultz, he became somewhat sinister and malicious. He would sleep with a male partner at a bathhouse in San Francisco or somewhere else. And then when the light came up, according to Randy Schultz, he would say, I've got gay cancer.
Now you're going to get it too.
You talk to him.
I talked to him, yeah.
This is Dr. Selma Dritz. She was part of that CDC study.
I told him that he was getting other people sick with it. And he said, my right to do whatever I want, my civil rights, I do as I please. I've got it. Why shouldn't they have it? They said, you can kill yourself if you want, but you've got no right to take somebody else along with you. And he said, screw you, and walked out.
Really a chilling moment.
And pretty much from that moment on, Gaetan Dugas...
He just took on this aura. as single-handedly causing an epidemic in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know about you, but I first bumped into this story in the movie version of In the Band Played On.
My friend, we're talking about thousands of men whose faces I cannot even remember, and you want names.
That's an actor playing Gaten Dukat in the movie. Now, when I first saw that, AIDS had already infected 2.5 million people, and to think that it could all go back to this one guy just seemed unreal.
It was a very potent story, there's no doubt. And he gave HIV to a lot of people. There's no question about that. But what we do know is that he was not patient zero.
He was not patient zero.
No.
He was not the beginning point.
He wasn't.
Not even close. So here's the question that got me started on the story. Okay, so The Gay Steward, that was the movie stuck in my head. But what's the real movie? What movie can we make about the beginning of the AIDS epidemic? Because when you've got something so vast that, according to some estimates, will have killed 60 million people by the end of the decade, well, you need a beginning. You need some way of explaining how this disaster happened and how it might happen again.
And how exactly do we know that Gaten Dukat wasn't patient zero?
Well, there are a couple reasons we know it. So one thing that people started to do,
scientists,
was to started going back and looking at people who had died.
People who died mysteriously.
AIDS-like things.
In the past.
Might some of them have been early cases?
And they started finding a lot.
Robert Rayford had AIDS 12 years before it was recognized in this country in 1959. A sailor in Britain died of pneumocystis pneumonia.
And so, for a while, you had all these new patient zeros.
In 1961, a nurse in Chicago died of Kaposi's sarcoma.
But the real definitive blow to this whole patient zero nonsense came by actually looking at the virus itself.
In 1984, same year that Gaten Dukat died, scientists isolate the virus.
HIV.
Which is really just a little string of genetic code that gets into your body and into your cells and uses your cells to make copies of itself. But here's the thing.
When it replicates within a single patient, it copies itself imprecisely. It mutates quickly. It changes a lot.
As the virus duplicates itself inside a person, the dupes often have little copying errors in them, little mutations. And it turns out those errors, they happen at a predictable rate. You can kind of almost predict how many you're going to see in a year or 5 years. And so the amount of changes that you see out there, the diversity, really, of the viruses in the AIDS population, well, that becomes really good information. And so a group of scientists began to look at
the amount of diversity among HIV patients in the U.S.
and other parts of the world.
And the more diversity, the longer the virus has been around.
Right, right.
And they could use that kind of like a clock. If you have a virus here and a virus there,
you could measure how different they are, and you would know that it would take a certain amount of time for them to get that different. And to make a long story short,
the picture they get is
that AIDS entered the United States
around 1966.
At a time when Gaten Dukat was still a virginal adolescent.
From there, scientists were able to trace the virus back to Haiti, and from Haiti, back to Africa.
It's been there the longest. It's had the longest time to become diverse, to mutate, to evolve. So if you want to get to the real patient zero, as it were, the most interesting stuff actually comes from Africa. So one way to try to figure out its origins there is to go looking for the virus.
Yep, and that takes us back to ZR59 and DRC60. Can we talk about them?
Sure.
What?
These are the two earliest known HIV-positive human specimens.
And this is where, for me at least, the story gets way bigger than I imagined. Now, the first sample,
ZR59,
came to light in the late 90s. Somehow, scientists unearthed a very old tube of blood from a hospital in Kinshasa in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And when they tested it,
it had HIV. This had been taken from a Bantu man in 1959.
1959.
Yeah, nobody knows his name. Nobody even knows, I think, what he died of. And that was the only one for a number of years.
That was our one glimpse into the kind of deep history of HIV.
But then along comes that guy, Michael Warraby. He's an evolutionary biologist at the University of Arizona. And a few years ago, Michael went back to Kinshasa and found a second HIV sample. He actually found the virus lurking in a tiny bit of human tissue that was preserved in paraffin wax.
It's kind of like Han Solo in the Star Wars movie when he's kind of frozen in that carbonite or whatever that stuff is.
In this new sample, it was from the same town, Kinshasa, as the first, and also, more importantly, from the same time.
1960. And with the two of them, then you can kind of go back in time. And so,
yes, like we described before, you can measure the differences between the samples, calculate how long it would take for those samples to get that different. And in the end, you can use these two samples to wind the clock all the way back to the virus that started it all. And it turned out
the most recent common ancestor of those two specimens
goes back
to about 1908.
1908. That is when it started in human beings.
What? 1908? Is that what he said?
Well, roughly.
Give or take a margin of error.
Early 1900s.
Wow.
So around 1908, give or take, something happened.
That's right. That moment is the spillover.
Spillover.
Spillover is the term the scientists use to describe the moment when a virus in one species passes into another species.
You know, new diseases in humans tend to pop up from animals. So people said, okay, flu comes from birds. Where does HIV come from? To get at that answer, you have to look beyond human beings. You have to look at other viruses that are like HIV.
So the search was on.
The inability to find a similar disease in research animals.
Turns out right about the time that the HIV virus was discovered,
but scientists at the New England Primate Research Center,
some researchers found a virus like it in macaque monkeys.
Macaque monkey.
In fact, it was so similar that they called it
SIV.
Simian immunodeficiency virus.
Yes, and that's where the origin quest started.
This is Beatrice Hahn.
I'm a professor of medicine and microbiology at the University of Pennsylvania.
And so after they found it in macaques, what happened?
It took a couple of years.
But eventually, she says, they found SIV.
And still another primate species, the Sooty Mangabe.
And then in a few more.
The African green monkeys, mandrills.
Pretty soon it was all over the place.
There are now, I think, 40 different species of African monkeys known to have their own version of SIV.
So then the question was, which one of these monkeys or primates passed it to us?
Then, unexpectedly,
a researcher named Martine
Peters,
at this center in Gabon,
decided to test her chimps.
Two orphan chimpanzees.
And bingo. She found a very, very close match.
A virus that was the closest relative of HIV-1.
So?
Everybody said, well, you know.
It was a chimp.
It was a chimp. Okay.
Yeah, it came from a chimp.
Yes.
But then the question was, well, which chimps? Or rather, where?
Where exactly?
So?
Beatrice Hahn and her colleagues started looking at chimps that came from different parts of Western Central Africa.
Now, getting blood samples from chimps in the wild is pretty much...
It just isn't feasible.
You know, because in the wild, they hide the moment they see us.
So you get stuck with fecal samples.
It's poop.
Huh.
Yes, poop.
There's lots of DNA in there.
And viruses.
So they would just go to where the chimpanzees would sleep at night, and they would just, you know, collect some poop.
Bring it back to the lab, and Beatrice would analyze all the viruses.
Over 90 different wild communities.
From every part of Central Africa.
Over 7,000 different fecal samples.
And slowly, they were able to piece together
which communities were infected and which ones had the closest to HIV-1. That's when it hit us for the first time.
What exactly hit you?
The geographic origin of these chimps.
In 2006, her and her colleagues published that the human AIDS virus comes from a group of chimps, a very specific group that live in a very specific place.
This little corner of southeastern Cameroon.
Between the Boumba River, the Ngoka River, and the Sanga River.
These chimps were essentially penned in between these three rivers.
It's an area probably only of 100 square miles, not much more than that.
Wow.
So when we're looking at what humans have, and we're looking at what all of those chimps in Africa have, the most perfect match is this little territory up there in Cameroon.
Yeah.
There is no other virus that is any closer. So that's that.
So can you reconstruct the spillover and the who that it spilled over into as best as we understand it?
You can hypothesize. And the best hypothesis is the cut hunter hypothesis.
The cut hunter?
The CUT hunter?
That's right. A hunter who gets cut.
And what can we say about this guy? I mean, what do we know about him?
If we had to guess, that human was probably a Bantu man living very near the forest or in the forest in southeastern Cameroon. He was hunting. Maybe he had a bow and arrow. Maybe he had a spear. And He kills a chimpanzee. Bingo, here's a big pile of meat. And he starts to butcher it. He's cutting open the chest cavity, he's pulling out organs, and he cuts himself. And he gets blood-to-blood contact. Chimpanzee blood against his blood. What happens is that the virus in the chimpanzee blood found itself in an environment that was unexpected, that was alien to it, but was not too much different from the biochemical environment it had been in, chimpanzee blood. It could function. And that's the moment. That's the moment it begins. That human is patient zero.
But why then? Why 1908? I mean, presumably people have been hunting chimps for a really long time. Why wouldn't this guy be patient 7 million?
That's another of the big questions. People certainly in Central Africa have been eating monkeys for thousands of years.
I mean, David says there's really no way to know, but this could have just been the right virus.
Maybe this particular virus evolved in a way that made it more transmissible in humans.
Or maybe it just got lucky to come along at precisely the right time.
What you're looking at,
this is Carl again,
is a time when this part of Africa was being heavily colonized. The French and the Belgians were building train systems. The populations were on the move. Kinshasa, which was then Leopoldville, it was exploding. It was huge.
The cities were attracting people from the boonies in those days.
So by 1908, all the virus has to do is get from that tiny village where the cut hunter lived to one of the new cities.
That happens almost certainly by river. I was stirred by the work of Beatrice Hahn and Mike Warby to see what this scenario looked like on the ground. So I went to southeastern Cameroon and I chartered a little boat, about a 30-foot wooden boat with an outboard motor.
And he traced the path of the virus.
We went down the Ngoko River and we stopped at a few villages. There are a couple little villages there, one of which has a market where you can buy monkey meat and crocodile meat.
And he says it wasn't hard to imagine how it all might have went down. Perhaps the cut hunter gave the virus to a woman, who then passed it on to a fisherman.
Fellow that I call the Voyager.
Who then got in a boat, as David did, and carried it down the river.
The Sanga River, which is the Ngoko is a tributary of the Sanga. Sanga becomes a bigger river, 200 meters wide, which then flows to the Congo River, the big river.
And into the city.
And I imagine him sliding into Brazzaville around 1920, the first HIV positive man to arrive in an urban center where there's a much greater density of humans, where there are prostitutes, a greater fluidity of social and sexual interactions. And that seems to have been the place from which the disease went global.
So that's how it happened.
We could take it back even farther, actually.
What do you mean?
Farther? Well, because if you want to make a movie about the start of it, well, this is not the start. Because we got it from chimps, right?
Right.
So you could ask, who was Chimp Zero? What do we know about Chimp Zero, right?
Yeah, I mean, everything comes from somewhere. And again, by molecular work, scientists have been able to determine that the chimp virus is actually...
It actually comes from...
Two monkey viruses.
Two different monkeys from two completely different species.
What? Would they have encountered each other somewhere? Or had a fight? Or?
They probably encountered each other in the stomach of a chimp.
Meaning what?
Well, from the perspective of a chimpanzee, monkeys, they look tasty.
This is Nathan Wolf,
professor in human biology at Stanford University.
And he says to fully understand this part of the patient, or rather chimp zero narrative, you have to grasp how it is that chimps hunt. And this is something he witnessed.
In the Kibali National Forest in southwestern Uganda.
He described to us watching three male chimps converge on a tree full of colobus monkeys, which are these very small black and white monkeys.
And one individual managed to grab two juveniles, and then the three individuals all met up and
began to eat the monkey while it was still alive.
The chimpanzee was going after an organ, you know, that obviously was a tasty morsel that he was going after, and the monkey was screaming bloody murder.
It is quite disturbing to watch, he says.
But one of the things that struck me at that moment was the depth of contact between the blood and body fluids of this monkey and the chimpanzee.
The chimps are literally covered in blood. They have blood on their face and in their eyes. And from the virus's perspective, this is spillover heaven. Okay, so the following is the closest that we can get to a zero point in this entire narrative. We don't know where it happened.
And we don't know exactly the time, say some hundreds of thousands of years ago.
From the molecular clock, we know it was less than a million years. That's all we know. But whenever it was, Chimp Zero was hunting, and it comes upon a monkey called a red-capped mangabey.
The red-capped mangabey, this is a larger primate.
And these are tree-dwelling little guys?
Tree-dwelling.
A little bit of red fur on their heads.
Yes.
Chimp Zero spots one of these monkeys, eats it. And in the process, he catches a red-capped mangabey version of the AIDS virus. Next, sometime after that first kill, weeks, months, we don't know, maybe it was the same day, Chimp Zero comes across another monkey. And this monkey was called a spot-nosed guenon.
Yes.
It's got a spot on its nose, I assume.
There you go.
Very small.
One of the tiniest monkeys of all of the old world monkeys.
And Chimp Zero eats that monkey and gets a spot-nosed guenon version of the AIDS virus, or the SIV virus, inside it.
So you've got the red-capped mangabey, and you've got the spot-nosed guenon. So you've got a guenon and a mangabey.
Two completely different kinds of SIV viruses inside the same chimp. Now, under normal circumstances, according to Nathan, both of these SIV viruses would go nowhere. Because
when one of these viruses makes the jump,
they go from a place they've adapted to, and that they know, to a completely foreign landscape.
Like a human being dropped off on Mars, maybe without a spacesuit.
Huh.
I mean, they basically are entering a completely alien habitat. The cells don't look the same. The environment is different.
And the chimp's immune system would normally kill them.
But then once in a blue moon,
something crazy happens. These two viruses will end up inside the same cell in the same chimp at the same time.
Literally, there is a single cell simultaneously infected with both viruses.
So suppose on one side of the cell you've got the mangabey virus, and on the other side of the same cell you've got the spot-nosed guenon virus.
And what happens is, literally,
inside the cell,
you have an enzyme, it's called the polymerase enzyme, that's copying genetic information of the viruses.
This is what viruses do. They hijack these enzymes to make copies of themselves. Now, here's the problem.
These enzymes, they're not necessarily that sticky.
And while they're in the process of copying one virus,
every once in a while,
they'll accidentally fall off mid-copy
and
go thwack
and latch on
to the second virus and just keep on copying. And so, what it ends up spitting out is a hybrid. Like that. Now, this new mosaic probably won't go anywhere because 99.999999% of the time, when these hybrids happen,
it's a dead end.
The chimp's immune system is pretty sophisticated. It has evolved defenses against these viruses and it will destroy them. But again, once in a blue moon.
So this is a blue moon after a blue moon after a blue moon to really get this. Finally, you get one particular mosaic virus between the mangabey and the guenon
that through sheer random luck works. It landed on the exact right combination of genes that allowed it to evade the chimp's immune system.
I mean, one of the amazing things to think about is how many hopeful monsters you had to have in order to get that one that actually survived.
Probably trillions. But then,
boom.
Suddenly, in a flash, from these two viruses that can barely survive in the chimp, you get a new virus.
A little bit mangabey, a little bit guenon.
Can not only survive in the chimp, but can thrive. In fact, for this baby virus, the chimp is the perfect host.
And that was the virus that ended up spreading, jumping over into humans, and has been this massive and incredibly dramatic sort of tear in the fabric of humanity.
Let me add another parenthesis. There are essentially 12 major groups of the HIV virus.
What David means is that 12 different kinds of HIV viruses have spilled over 12 different times.
8 of them came from monkeys, 3 of them came from chimps, and 1 came from gorillas.
Wow.
And of those 12, only one of them is responsible for the global pandemic.
Wow, there are 12 kinds.
12 times that we know about. It's probably happened dozens and dozens more times that we don't know about. So the spillover is not a highly improbable event.
These sorts of viruses, they're constantly pinging at us. They're pinging at us and pinging it at us. We see it happening all the time.
You see it happening?
All the time.
Nathan has set up a series of monitoring stations.
In places like Central Africa.
And he and his colleagues have been tracking what he calls the viral chatter in the people who hunt these primates.
We collected specimens from the animals that they were hunting.
They compared that to blood samples from the hunters themselves.
And guess what? We found a whole range of new retroviruses that were moving over into these hunters.
For example, he's been tracking something called the simian foamy virus, which is
a virus in the same family as HIV.
And he has seen it hop from an individual gorilla to an individual human who killed that gorilla.
Yeah, these are almost certainly what we call primary transmission events.
Oh, so you really are looking at the potential beginning of something.
Yes. Like, so if you want a patient zero, really clear patient zero, it's some of these individuals that have been infected with these viruses. And the real question is, how do we stop patient zeros? How do we avoid patient
one and patient two?
Exactly.
So Nathan is developing a series of tools like
digital surveillance. I mean, some of these places, I work in some places in Democratic Republic of Congo. You basically have to fly in to get there.
No roads, often no electricity. But
many of these places, they still have cell phone towers.
So Nathan has begun to track cell phone call patterns in these communities. So if he sees a blip of many calls to a medical center within a short period of time,
okay, boom, now we got to investigate that. And we continue to find viruses that are completely novel, and we're looking to determine if these are the next HIV.
Because think about it, he says, HIV landed in humans in 1908, but we didn't know about it until 1981.
We had decades of time when this was a virus before it spread globally.
What if we'd been looking for it? A lot of people to thank for this segment. Thanks to Nathan Wolf.
For being Nathan.
And he has an awesome new book called The Viral Storm.
Also, thank you to Carl Zimmer, whose book on viruses is called A Planet of Viruses. And thank you also to him and to Michael Warby. Their interview was recorded on a podcast from Meet the Scientist, which you can find at microbeworld.org.
And thanks to David Quammen, who's got a book called Spillover coming out very soon, which is all about diseases crossing over from animals to us.
And also to Beatrice Hahn of the University of Pennsylvania.
And to Katie Slocum from the University of York for letting us use her recordings of chimpanzees.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.